From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The House of Representatives is set to begin voting this hour on the Republican health care overhaul plan intended to do away with President Obama's signature health reform law. It's been changed, the Republicans has, since it was pulled from a vote 6 weeks ago. The Congressional Budget Office scorecard of that original Republican bill said it would cause 24 million people to lose coverage over the next decade. That gave lawmakers pause, but they are voting today on a revised bill which has not been scored and has added funding to bring two balking moderate Republicans on board, and also added a measure meant to bring conservatives on board. It allows states to waive mandatory insurance coverage for some people with pre-existing conditions. This is expected to be a close vote, and debate on the floor this morning was impassioned. Democrats like Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas blasted the bill.
I want you to look and keep your eyes on who will feel the Trump Cares mother of all bombs of health care dropped on the American people. God have mercy on your soul.
But Republican Doug Collins of Georgia responded this way.
Mr. Speaker, if I had to defend Obamacare, I'd go into hysterics, too. So, since Obamacare went into effect, the insurance choices and coverage have gotten lower and the costs have gotten higher. Virtually no doctors take the marketplace insurance, so I'm left to change doctors.
Joining us now, NPR congressional correspondent Jeff Bennett. Jeff, lawmakers usually whip these things up. They know the votes in advance. The Republicans say they have them. But is it possible there are undecided Republicans at this point, or maybe Republicans changing their minds?
I think that's certainly the case, and it's also true that there will be members who make up their minds as they go to vote. But the Republican lawmakers I spoke with this morning were confident that this revamped bill will pass. There was a real profound sense of optimism that had really been absent all week. But, you know, Robin, this vote will be a nail-biter because the other thing Republicans said this morning is that they expect this bill to pass by a razor-thin margin of just one or two votes. So this really, you know, it's a pivotal moment, especially since the Republican Party's last attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, failed in really a spectacular fashion just over a month ago. And you'll remember that's when House GOP leaders pulled the bill ahead of a scheduled vote because it didn't have enough support to pass. But, you know, things have moved very quickly this week, and the bill has new momentum, mainly because of the reasons you outlined earlier, thanks mainly to that amendment to the bill negotiated by Congressman Tom MacArthur. He aligns with moderates, and he negotiated that change that allows states to opt out of Obamacare's current requirement that insurance companies really charge people the same regardless of whether they have a pre-existing condition. But Republicans felt like that change would have left some of their older and less healthy constituents without crucial protections. A great deal of Republicans felt that way. Well. And so this week, Congressman Fred Upton, he negotiated yet another amendment that provides $8 billion over 5 years to help fund what are known as high-risk pools. Those are pools of sicker people, and that would apply to those states that opt out of their pre-existing conditions or the protections for pre-existing conditions.
So they've added money to appease the moderate Republicans who are worried about losing the, you know, the coverage of pre-existing conditions. But what happens now with the budget hawks? I mean, this was the criticism of Obamacare, that it needed government funding to be propped up.
That's right. And I would say that the Republicans who I spoke with this morning were glossing over some of the details. The bigger issue that they're really intent on is just passing this bill. It's a priority for the president. It's something that they've campaigned on. It's something they've tried to do for the last 7 years. And so with this new momentum, they see light at the end of the proverbial tunnel. And so they're really intent on passing this bill in the House and then in the Senate. We can talk later about, you know, what this bill means in the Senate.
Well, you know, later usually never comes. So let's do it right now. What is the sense that even if the House Republicans feel they have to pass this, the Senate Republicans will?
Well, right. Well, it's true that passage in the House here is the easier lift. The bill in its current form has zero chances in the Senate. This is really a template. But here's the big problem in the Senate, Robin. Whereas House Republicans can only afford to lose 22 votes and still pass the legislation without Democratic support, in the Senate, they can only lose two senators, speaking of the Republicans. And so GOP conservatives like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz are not anywhere on the same page with GOP moderates like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. But speaking, you know, to the substance of the bill, some of the changes, they could add more money for pre-existing conditions. They could add more tax credit money for people who are low income. They could give a longer runway for the end of a Medicaid expansion. But I'll point out, you know, whereas you heard some Republicans sort of poo-pooing the House attempt in the last go-around, people like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, you haven't seen them say negative things about this latest attempt. And that's because Senate Republicans know they also need to help produce a victory, or the entire party might suffer in 2018.
Right. In the midterms. Jeff Bennett, who covers Congress for NPR, will keep an eye on all of this today. Jeff, thank you.
Sure thing.
Well, the longest war in U.S. history shows no signs of ending. I'm talking about the war in Afghanistan, which started in 2001. In 2014, President Obama announced the end of U.S. combat operations there. But today, Marines are again patrolling Helmand Province to fight the resurgent Taliban. And last week, two U.S. Army Rangers died in a firefight with ISIS. Joining us now is Eli Lake, a columnist for Bloomberg View. And Eli, President Trump hasn't said yet what his Afghanistan strategy will be, but you write that the interventionist members of his national security team are winning the debate. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that at this point, the proposal or the strategy that he will be presented and he's going to have to sign off on or send back will call for a U.S. strategy where, first of all, there won't be an arbitrary deadline for the removal of U.S. troops. We're seeing already Marines in Helmand, and you're going to see an increase of combat operations that Obama had said were over in 2014. But it will also tie success of any U.S. mission in Afghanistan to the success of the government of Ashraf Ghani, who has tried to have an inclusive government from Kabul that would genuinely rule the country and to take back territory from the Taliban, which some estimates say they control up to 40% of the country. Other estimates say that it's a little bit less than that. So that is a pretty ambitious strategy at this point. It's very much reminiscent of the counterinsurgency push that President Obama approved in his first year in office in 2009, that I think he soon had buyer's remorse about almost as soon as he authorized it.
Do you expect more U.S. troops to go to Afghanistan? There are about 9,000 there now.
I would expect under the strategy, if Trump does in fact approve it, but the dilemma here, I think, for the president is that in many ways he campaigned against the idea of nation building. I mean, that is one of the central tenets of the notion of America First. And this is would be nation building by any other name. It would mean that we would invest more money in anti-corruption efforts in Kabul. The Afghan government is one of the most corrupt on the planet. It would mean that the U.S. would continue to subsidize the police and the armed forces of the country. There would be a pretty big ask, I think, as well for NATO allies to get back into the fight as well. So in many ways, it's a sort of renewed push in Afghanistan, an escalation in order to consolidate gains for the government of Ashraf Ghani, who is perceived, I think, by particularly H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, as a real American ally.
And the people who are making the case for more intervention in Afghanistan by the United States, what case are they making? Why is it so important for the U.S. to spend now 16 years plus in that country?
If you just were to completely leave the country now, or you were to have a scaled back counterterrorism plan and the trend line would continue, I mean, the Taliban would continue to gain more and more territory. And Afghanistan would in many ways be back to where it was before 9/11, when it was a safe haven for Al-Qaeda as that group plotted the horrific attacks of 2001. So nobody can have that. And if you look at, for example, the withdrawal of U.S. forces in 2011 from Iraq, it is perceived by H.R. McMaster and H.R. McMaster's mentor, David Petraeus, and others in that sort of side of the policy debate as a huge mistake to have gotten out of Iraq in 2011 without trying harder to get an amendment to the Status of Forces Agreement, because this was one of the factors that paved the way for the reemergence of the Islamic State. You know, in 2011, Al-Qaeda in Iraq had largely been defeated. That's the predecessor organization of the Islamic State. By 2014, the Islamic State had controlled Iraq's second largest city of Mosul and a big chunk of territory in Syria. So at this point, the argument is you may want to pull out early, and it may be easy to do, and it may look okay for few months or a few years, but eventually you're going to have to come back in if you allow this kind of territory to become a safe haven again.
Isn't that a case, though, that could be made forever?
Yes, that's the downside of it. And I would say that there's a strong case to be made that it is throwing good money after bad. We may never be able to really put together a competent Western kind of military in Afghanistan as much as we'd like to. We try and we invest resources into it.
Who's making the argument within the Trump administration against intervention in Afghanistan?
Well, one voice that you've heard, I have not been able to fully confirm it, is Gary Cohn, who's the chief economic advisor. I think that Steve Bannon, even though he's not on the National Security Council, is really skeptical of these kinds of larger interventions. And there are others inside the military. There was a plan that called for a lighter footprint and more of a kind of counterterrorism approach with drone strikes. But ultimately, the McMaster view prevailed. And I think that that's something that's shared by James Mattis, the former four-star Marine Corps general, who's now the Secretary of Defense, and others on the military side.
That's Eli Lake, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How much does the Republican push to repeal Obamacare have to do with the word Obama? It's just one of many Obama-era policies that the Trump administration has wasted no time trying to get rid of. Earlier this week, the Trump administration also went after Michelle Obama's school lunch guidelines and decided to end her Let Girls Learn education program. So, how much of this is about policy, and how much is about a deep dislike of former President Obama? Joining us are Here Now political analyst Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Okay, well, let's listen here to President Trump talking to John Dickerson on CBS about President Obama.
Did President Obama give you any advice that was helpful? That you think, wow,
he was very nice to me, but after that, we've had some difficulties. So it doesn't matter. You know, words are less important to me than deeds. And you saw what happened with surveillance, and everybody saw what happened with surveillance.
Difficulties how?
I thought that, well, you saw what happened with surveillance, and I think that was inappropriate.
What does that mean, sir?
You can figure that out yourself.
Well, the reason I asked is you said you called him sick and bad.
Look, you can figure it out yourself. He was very nice to me with words, and when I was with him. But after that, there has been no relationship.
Paris, what do you think that's about?
Listen, I think what we have here is the president expressing how difficult it is to govern when you have such a divided nation and quite frankly, a media who is thriving off of the divisiveness of this election cycle and conflict. And so while I believe the president... Trump was talking accurately when he said President Obama and him had a good cordial relationship. As of right now, it hasn't been that way. And I think it's just
why not, though? What did Obama do to Trump? Because what he mentions there is the surveillance stuff, but there's no evidence of that at this point.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if President Obama did anything to President Trump other than he hasn't gone out of his way to make sure that there was a smooth a transition and a respectful dialogue between the president's administration cabinet and some of his officials. Look, when you have the president's photographer sort of trolling President Trump at every turn about everything
he's done. You're talking about Pete Souza, who's got an Instagram account, and he has been, I think trolling would be a good way of describing it.
So, I mean, you have those things that have been happening, and there seems to be no willingness to be like the George W. Bush's administration was towards President Obama's administration in terms of the willingness to not weigh in and not be political and actually make sure that they have their time to shine. It's their moment. It's your administration. You own it. We'll let you have it. But we won't be opining and going out of our way to criticize as much as this administration's past administration has seems to have been doing.
Jamal, okay. Yeah, what do you think,
okay.
Jamal?
Okay. I just think that that's completely wrong. Listen, number one, Barack Obama has said nothing about Donald Trump since Donald Trump assumed the White House and assumed the Oval Office. So I think whatever trouble President Trump has with President Obama, it's something that only exists inside of his head. As for the transition, I think all the folks who were there during the transition on both sides were very complimentary of the Obama administration, working with them and trying to see them. The problem is people like Susan Rice, who never got to see Lieutenant General Michael Flynn before, like the week before the inauguration. The Trump folks did not put people in place in order to have a smooth transition. We've still got hundreds of jobs that are left open. I think President Trump needs to look in the mirror and needs to decide whether or not he wants to really do the hard work of being president and not point fingers at Barack Obama.
But do you buy that this is about the transition and how the transition went, Jamal? And I want to play, before we talk about that, a clip of Trump on the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News in August of last year, talking about Obama during the campaign.
I think he's the worst president maybe in the history of our country. I think he's been a disaster. He's been weak. He's been ineffective. You look at this so-called recovery, it's setting record lows.
Now, the worst president in the history of the country is something that I feel like that's not the first time somebody has said that during a campaign about the current president. But how much of this is about just getting the Trump base excited versus actual deep dislike of Obama?
President Trump has been very devoted to the 40 or so percent of people who are in his base and who would love him regardless of what he did or said. He has been very devoted to them. What he has not done is anything to reach out to the 54% of Americans who voted for someone else. He has got to decide that this election is over and do that. And instead, what he's doing is blaming Barack Obama for some irrational reason, except for the fact that that very small minority of Americans who voted for him and who love him to pieces seem to be enthralled by their hatred of Barack Obama.
Paris?
Look, I think a lot of this, we have to just be honest. When you have an election, you have consequences. And one of the consequences of this election for the Democrats to understand is that the President Trump gets to appoint the cabinet he wants and have the agenda that he wants to put out about the country. And so what you have now, it's wrong when it comes to people saying that the President Trump wanted to get rid of the Michelle Obama, First Lady Obama's food program. The State Department said there have been no changes to the Let Girl Learn program at all, period. But what you do have is
no changes.
That's what the State Department said. That is a direct quote from the State Department and the Trump administration. But the other thing is this, Jeremy, the president has a right to change course through executive order and through policy to reflect his own agenda. So is it a rollback of Obama administration policies because they don't agree with the policies? Yes. But is it because it was just President Obama? No. President Obama made changes that President Bush put in place because you have different opinion on how government works. And so I think we have to make sure that we are honest in how we are articulating what President Trump is doing. I think it's less personal and more policy.
Well, and it's not just President Trump also. Let's listen here to Rush Limbaugh talking in February on Fox News Sunday about why Obama's agenda got passed when he first took office.
You have a first African-American president. You have everybody falling all over themselves to acknowledge that, to reward that. Obama was going to get everything he wanted in the first year, because if anybody opposed it, they were going to be accused of being a racist or bigot or who knows what.
How much, Jamal, do you think that this is about race, the animosity? And we'll say, even if you take Trump out of the equation, the animosity, the hatred on the part of some of Obama.
Oh, I think there are some people who've never liked the fact that we had an African-American president. I still don't think that's most of the country. Obviously, the president got elected twice, so it's hard to say that most of the country was against him because of race. But it's clear that that was a factor in what animates this very small minority of people who are so devoted to being against anything Barack Obama put his fingers on.
Paris, what do you think?
I listen, there are elements of people who just don't like President Obama, never will like President Obama for a whole host of reasons. I count me in as one of the people who did not like the policies of President Obama. I wanted President Obama to be successful just as much as I want President Trump to be successful. But the problem we have is that his policies that I think that he put in place, in my opinion, and a lot of Americans and particularly Republicans' opinions, were not helpful, were not good, were not positive for the country. And so you have to be, I think we have to just be sure not to always run to race as to the reason, but also a lot of this is pure and simple politics. Listen, President Trump right now is not getting a lot of the victories that he wants early on. And that's not because he's a white man. It's not because the CBC hates white people. It's because if you look at the own Republican caucus, the Freedom Caucus and others were standing in opposition to some of the things that he was trying to do legislatively. So you can't turn to race on that. A lot of this has to do with ideological differences and straight politics. You have Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who within the first 100 days is already calling for impeachment.
Right.
There's obstruction on the other side as well, just not to him as a person, but to his agenda, because it's policy and it's politics.
All right. I want to just play one more piece of tape, because this is one that people point to as maybe a reason why Trump has some issues with President Obama. This was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011, when then-President Obama made fun of Trump, who had already been questioning Obama's birthplace.
Now, I know that he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing?
And you can't see it in that clip, obviously, but
oh,
Trump is
it.
Not happy in the
no.
video.
Stone face.
Yeah. No, and I got it. You know, I listened to that, and I listened to it with my heart aches, because I feel like that may have been the moment Donald Trump decided he wanted to run for president.
You think? Paris, you've spoken to Donald Trump. What do you think?
I have.
Is that the moment that he decided to run for president?
No, I think he knew far before that. But listen, the president is the president who wants to win. And he wants to be better than President Obama. He wants to be better than President George W. Bush. But he really wants to show the American people that who have undercutted him at every turn to say, listen, I can do this. I can be a leader. I can be a statesman. And I will do a better job than President Obama could have ever done for a whole host of communities, including the black community.
And, you know, if he really wanted to do that, he needs to replace Paul Ryan, because what he needs is a Nancy Pelosi type figure. Nancy Pelosi delivered for Barack Obama every single week she was speaker and he was president.
That's Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, both here now, political analysts. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
There's more news of racism at Boston's Fenway Park. A white Red Sox fan has been banned for life for uttering a racial slur at a game, the very same week that Baltimore Orioles outfielder Adam Jones said a fan at Fenway Park heckled him with the N-word. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And what do you make of these incidents and the reaction to them?
Let's take the second one first, second one in time, which was the fan. So what happened was, during the national anthem, someone in the bleachers apparently said an epithet to about the singer. And another fan told security that this was said, and the person who uttered the original utterance said it again, and boom, he was out. And the president of the Red Sox said, we're not going to take this. Maybe they're a bit more sensitive since the earlier incident with the great player Adam Jones. So that's a stance that the Red Sox have taken. Now, earlier, it seems to have been a yell, a catcall from the stands at Fenway. They have not identified who actually said it. Other black major leaguers have said, yes, when we go to Boston, we expect this, even more so than some other cities. C.C. Sabathia, an African-American pitcher for the Yankees, said, used to get it all the time with the Indians. Now that I'm with the Yankees, we have our own security. We don't get it so much. But it's known, or it has been reported as widely known among the few, and fewer still, African-American players in baseball, that the Fenway fans will engage and will catcall them with nasty racial slurs.
So you think this is more of a Boston thing than a baseball thing?
No, I think it's an American thing. And I'm just saying that what the major league players have said is that we get this in Boston. Of course, in Boston, the fans are closer to the stadium. It's a small ballpark. That might be an effect. You know, in Boston, they're really nasty to the other fans. You know, when the say the Yankees play on the road in Florida, in Tampa, mostly Yankee fans show up. I mean, there's a whole number of reasons that it could happen. I'm just saying that the other black players have said, yep, we've heard this in Fenway before.
What about when you look at Major League Baseball as a whole, though? The audience, according to Nielsen, is 83% white.
Yeah, and the player pool is 60-something percent white, but among African-Americans, it's around 7 or 8%. In fact, it fell from 8-point-something to 7-point-something because of, just judging from the opening day rosters, because four players were on the DL to start the season. When you deal with numbers that small, you know, one or two players being hurt can hurt the overall population of African-American players. There has been an influx of Asian, but especially Latin players in the game, so it is still majority white, not as white as when Jackie Robinson broke in, but not as black as, you know, two decades after Jackie Robinson broke in. At its height, I don't know that baseball ever had more than 20% African-American players. It has been reported that they had, but, you know, recent researchers have gone back and said it really wasn't that high. They included Afro-Latino players in that number, but it is down. And baseball is trying to reverse this. I have a few thoughts on that. I've talked to many people, many African-American baseball fans who are older, and they usually say it's a shame. They remember Jackie Robinson as pretty much the most important person in their life other than Martin Luther King. But I just think that young black kids are choosing other sports, which might not be a horrible thing. Mm. But like I said, baseball wants a more diverse playing field.
That's Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You are welcome.
This week, Netflix said it would add an additional alert to the beginning of every show in its new Netflix series about a high schooler who commits suicide, leaving behind 13 recordings meant for the 13 people she holds responsible for her death. It's called 13 Reasons Why. It's based on the popular YA book. We'll link you to our interview with author Jay Asher at hearnow.org. But here's a bit of the new show.
Settle in, because I'm about to tell you the story of my life. More specifically, why my life ended. And if you're listening to this tape, you're one of the reasons why.
Well, since the series debuted, educators say they're seeing an increase in dangerous behavior in teens, things like cutting and suicide threats. School districts are urging parents to discourage their kids from watching it or watch with them. We want to check in with two moms doing just that. Libby Ziegler joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Her kids are 11, 13, and 15. And Libby, is it fair to say you think the series is worthwhile, but you have some caveats?
That's right.
Okay. And joining us in the studio, Becky Manley from Newton, Massachusetts. Her teens are 16, 18, and 19. Good luck to you with all of that. You definitely have concerns about watching the show.
I do. Absolutely do.
Start with your concerns, Becky.
So I think a couple of things are really troubling. Number one is it's the story about Hannah. And she, like a lot of teens, is searching to be recognized, popular, and accepted. And I feel like what the show does is it makes these things happen for her after she commits suicide. Mm. And so for me, it sends this message to not just my girls, I work as a teen coach, but also some of my clients that this is something that is successful and will get you what you want.
Well, Libby, take that up because, you know, we as adults know how final death is. But the show does give the impression that a young girl commits suicide, and then she's the star of a TV show because it's in flashback. I know you have concerns, but what are the reasons that you're sort of leaning towards watching it?
I watched this show simultaneously with my 15-year-old. We were not in the same room. I watched it first, and then he watched a few episodes at a time. We got together, and we talked about it. So I think that opening up all of these conversations and opening up his thought process and my thought process about the differences in reality and what the show portrayed. I mean, I think that the producers of the show got a lot of things right. I definitely think that they got a couple of things wrong. And I think that to the point that they made Hannah in the end appear as a star or have all these things that perhaps she wanted and did not get when she was alive, that's one of the things they definitely missed. But I think that having these really hard conversations, they have to happen.
Well, and Becky, what about that? That you're nodding yes, that this is generating conversations that may not have happened.
I definitely agree. My worry is that many of the kids watching this are not watching it with their parents. I watched it with my girls as well. However, I think the bulk of these kids are watching it in their rooms, on their iPads, on their laptops. The other really big concern that I have is that For my kids, if something happens, I want them to feel safe in their school environment and feel like they could go to their school counselor, which didn't happen in the show.
I'm going to jump in there because the National Association of School Psychologists is horrified by this because one of the characters, it's the second school counselor who dismisses some of Hannah's concerns. And school counselors are saying, no, that's not what will happen. And we need to telegraph to kids that they can go to school counselors. You were saying, Libby, there in San Francisco, that you were concerned that some of the things they got wrong. Are you concerned about that?
Absolutely. When I first watched the show, I found that piece of it hard to believe. Giving her only one option and saying, well, if you cannot provide me with names or your story, you know, the only other choice is just to get over it. It's really hard to imagine that a counselor would say that.
Mm. I just want to bring the listeners in who haven't seen this or read the book. It's pretty graphic. There's not just the suicide, but bullying, rape, drunk driving, slut shaming. You know, these are some of the things that the kids are trying to handle. And these things are happening. Isn't it good that parents are having to see it with their kids and talk to them about things like slut shaming?
I do think it's an excellent conversation to have, and it opens up that conversation for parents. I just wish they had been more balanced. They could have easily added a character feeling suicidal and then going to seek treatment and then getting the help she needed.
Well, that wasn't in the book.
It wasn't in the book, but if you're going to make a reality show that's targeted towards teenagers, I think they have a responsibility to show the other side and at least have a little bit more balance.
Well, Libby, who is watching it with caution with your kids, again, from the National Association of School Psychologists, they say, first of all, the parents should watch the series with their kids and talk about it. But they also say that the one message you must over and over again get across is suicide is not the answer and there's a cure. Do you find yourself talking about things like this with your kids, Libby?
Again, I have two teenagers in my house right now and one on the way. I have an 11-year-old, and they are three very different people. And allowing my 13-year-old to watch the show, I would not do. Mm. I don't want him to watch the show yet. We have talked about it, and he's fine with that. My 15-year-old, he's a very stable kid. He's a very emotionally intelligent kid. So our conversations have been more along the lines of, what would you do if you saw this? What would you do if one of your friends were depressed or something didn't feel right? His response to me was, if I felt that something was off with one of my friends, I wouldn't wait for them to come to me. I would go to them. And I think that was such a beautiful answer, you know, because there was something very positive that came out of this show for him. And I think that that message that he received is huge.
And he sounds great, actually. And you're nodding yes too, Becky, here in the studio. Are we, in telling kids how to react when their friends are depressed and how to react when they see these things, are we maybe burdening them too much with this, it's your role to save your friend, otherwise you're going to be one of the 13 reasons why? Becky, you're nodding.
That was one of the responses from my 18-year-old. First of all, she said Hannah had some mental illness that wasn't talked about in the film, but she said it also made it seem like everyone was to blame for her suicide. And she's right. And I think it's an issue especially among adolescent girls because they feel responsible sometimes for how their friends are feeling and they talk to each other. And sometimes I worry that, especially since the counselor wasn't helpful, that kids would talk to other kids versus going to an adult for help and guidance.
Just want to say, too, that I feel like is it asking a lot to pay attention to their friends and do something about it when they feel there's something going on? Yes and no. I mean, I feel like that's the direction I want my kid to go down life. I want him to keep his eyes opened.
So, Libby, what would you tell parents? Because right now the psychologists are saying, just ask your kids if they've watched it. Don't suggest they do. What would you say to other parents?
I would say that as a parent, you need to trust yourself. You need to, you know, in your gut, if your gut is telling you my kid is not ready to see something like this, or even if you're just questioning yourself if your child should see the show, then don't go there with them. Mm. Any child who is unstable or depressed or perhaps is going through one of these situations, I would not recommend this.
I'm wondering, too, if one of the thought that parents may be having now is, I don't want to hear about this. This is just so painful.
I think you're right. It is. I mean, for someone who watched it twice, not just once, I watched it twice. It was disturbing. It brings up a lot of hard issues, and it's issues that parents don't necessarily want to bring up with their kids.
Well, but maybe one of them is, I don't know what I'd do if you left me.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And especially the scenes where the suicide scene. It's almost like a how-to for committing suicide. Oh. Like, and if you have a kid who is really feeling badly, and you have a kid who's feeling like, oh my gosh, I just can't go on, and feeling just overwhelmed and having those suicidal thoughts, and then you have this how-to, and they watch the film, you just worry that it's giving them almost like a recipe of how to do it.
Yeah. That's Becky Manley, a parent of three from Newton. Also, Libby Ziegler before that, a parent of three from Oakland, California, weighing in on 13 Reasons Why, the new Netflix series. Thank you both so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it is tea time in the studio here. And our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, joins us to talk tea. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Jeremy.
Some people might have thought it was golf, but no.
No.
It's tea time.
Tea time. And it's my unbirthday, by the way.
Oh, well.
I think it's Robin's unbirthday as well.
Me? Oh, right. So a very merry unbirthday
so,
to you.
So let's all have some tea.
Let's have a spot of tea.
We're going full on high tea today.
This is the real deal. We don't scrimp here. I mean, I feel like all you hear about these days is coffee, you know, the barista, the cappuccino, your favorite place, how much you spend for your espressos. But tea has such a great history, and I feel like Downton Abbey and all the BBC programs, the elegant and refined and slowing down of time ritual of taking tea is something that could help us all out these days.
Well, but you're not talking about plopping a bag in the pot. Maybe you are at some point, but we've got these, you've got pots filled with herbs from your garden. We're going to strain them now.
You have a fresh mint tea. So I took dried mint from the garden last year and the first fresh mint this year, and that's called an herbal infusion. And then you have a strainer there. And Jeremy, you have a blend of black teas. It's called Queen Catherine by Harney and Sons. Oh. And it's a beautiful blend. And, you know, you could have paper-thin lemon slices, sugar, milk, cream. It's really up to you, and it depends on how long you want to steep it if you like it strong. But a quick tip is always pour boiling water into the pot first. It's almost like tempering the pot. Then you strain that out. Then you put your dry tea in. If you're having a formal high tea, or even if you're not, loose tea leaves make a way better pot of tea.
Yeah, it is really stunning how much better this is than if you just take a tea bag.
The cafeteria tea bag.
Exactly.
It's, you know, there's a reason they've been doing it like that for years. And tea bags are efficient and quick. And when you're on the run, of course, they make sense. But absolutely. But put the boiling water in first, take it out, and then make your hot tea.
And we'll have pictures in my pot, which is clear glass. You can see all the mint leaves in there.
Yeah, that's a pretty one.
Just beautiful.
Yeah.
But we also have these sandwiches.
Why, indeed we do. So
no crusts.
The idea of a tea is that these are very delicate, light sandwiches and light snacks. The story, apparently, and I'm sure there are many of them, is that in 1840, Anna Maria Stanhope, who was the 7th Duchess of Bedford, hit upon the idea of afternoon tea. I won't do the British accent because I'm not that good at it. Because they ate dinner at the fashionably late time of about 8 p.m. And so there was this hunger pang in late afternoon. And the idea was that you had tea sandwiches, biscuits or scones with clotted cream and cream and jam, and cakes. And that is what you will still get to this day at a formal tea in a restaurant all over England and Ireland and even in parts of here. So what we have is the open face sandwiches with the radishes. I whipped ricotta cheese and I grated some radishes and added fresh spring chives. And then I sliced radishes on top of it. And it's kind of peppery, but wakes you up, huh?
That is so good.
They're chewing. They can't talk. I will move on. Mm-hmm. Then there are some very adorable little dainty cucumber sandwiches. Now, that's on a white
bread. They're very dainty.
Aren't they so dainty? And I buttered the bread. And let me tell you, that's not as easy as it sounds. The butter has got to be soft. The bread can't be too cold, or the butter just sits there and
There's
rips the bread
on
apart.
These.
Very good. That was my surprise. There is fresh mint and fresh dill and coarse sea salt. So it's so simple that you'll when you go to the website, you'll see there's barely a recipe, but good bread, good butter, very thin cucumbers sliced, and a dash of fresh chopped mint.
and goes perfectly with tea.
I think so.
What's the brown bread?
The third one is a whole grain bread, which would not be a traditional British bread at all, although brown bread is. And that is watercress, another peppery spring green with cream cheese and fresh salt and pepper with just a paper thin slice of lemon on top.
And it wouldn't be complete without a scone.
Yes, that is a ginger and pistachio scone with a maple glaze. Oh. And scones tend to be so dry and I think kind of not that great a lot.
These are don't tell the British.
No, I love them when they're good. And I think this is a good one. So try it. It's extremely moist and light. And I love the pistachios on top sticking to the maple glaze. And there's dry ginger in there as well as crystallized ginger. And the beauty of this is that you can make the dough and freeze it or keep it in the fridge for a few days until you're going to have your tea.
Like till Mother's Day.
Mother's Day, this would be a lovely thing to do. And obviously, this is so much fun for kids, little itty-bitty ones, straight on up. I mean, putting butter on bread, putting cucumbers, designing little radishes on open-faced sandwiches. This is a great time of year to get kids involved and do the Mother's Day tea.
I have an English side of the family, and my grandmother still lives in England. Mm-hmm. And tea time is basically every hour and a half. But not with all these sandwiches.
That's
usually
better than
just
bar time.
Well,
right?
I was thinking, Jeremy, we have really got to up the bar on our 4 o'clock when we get hungry at 4 o'clock. We got to make it.
I'll just
look
pop
like this.
By with the little tea sandwiches and we will all. So cheers. Here's to.
Do you cheers you. With tea? Well, we'll
probably
we'll put
not.
All of these recipes up at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy Guntz, Here and Now resident chef, thanks as always.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Yes. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is, they'd be so proud. This is Here and Now.